welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name is Aaron.
And I'm Rustin.
Every 2 weeks, Russ and I get together to discuss topics in the field of ecology, natural history, and evolution. And this week, we're going to be talking about ants.
Yes. Yes, indeed. We had so much fun with the bug episode that we felt like it was necessary to specify and focus just on ants, because honestly, ants are some of the most fascinating bugs you can talk about.
There is so much going on with ants, and they're probably some of the most studied insects.
They are. That's true as well. That's true. And yet we still have a lot more to learn.
Oh, absolutely.
So much more to learn. So, you want to get us started then?
You're going to have to act surprised for everything. This is our second time recording.
Yeah, we had some network issues the first time we tried to record this, so I guess you guys get to get a decent idea of my acting capabilities. I've already heard parts of Aaron's bit. He's heard none of my bit.
Yeah, I haven't heard Rustin, so that'll be genuine, but
Right, you'll have to evaluate his acting chops another time.
All right, so today I'm going to be discussing a specific ant colony. Wow, that's insane!
Ants, what? That's crazy.
So not a specific species, but a specific colony today. So I will go over its discovery, some of the research done on it, and what they learned from it. And this is the story of the cannibal ant colony living inside an abandoned Soviet nuclear bunker.
Wow. That sounds so cool.
Yeah, never heard of that one before.
Whatever does that mean?
This takes place out in the woods of Western Poland, close to the German border. Poland has a very unique and fascinating history. And a big part of that history was the Cold War. So during this time, you know, the threat of nuclear warfare was very real, and a lot of countries invested in building lots of underground concrete bunkers. And many of these got abandoned. In the case of Poland, most were sealed up to prevent the public from entering. They likely still did. And these bunkers were actually built by the Soviets and acted as a form of nuclear weapons storage.
They weren't built as shelters. They were just built as places to store nukes.
Yeah, it was just for storage. And I don't know if there's actually anything stored in it ever. I don't know if this one actually saw use. There were a lot of these. They were kind of put up everywhere.
Okay.
Years go by and nature starts to reclaim. Many of these structures are closed off and forgotten in the grand scheme of history, but I'm sure people still knew about them. You know, if you're living in a rural area, bored teen, you probably know where to find all the cool abandoned stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best parts of being a teenager is you learn where all the cool abandoned stuff is.
Oh yeah, I had my local spots when I was growing up.
As did I, and I won't tell anyone about them because that would ruin the fun.
They're still mine, damn it. I want to go back there. I'm not too old.
Right, exactly.
You can pry them from my cold, dead hands.
By the way, I'm not too old is exactly what people say when they are too old. Yeah. Just for the record.
This particular structure was sealed up, minus a few cracks, which allowed some researchers to slip in, and a ventilation pipe or two. So for the most part, nothing could really get in. It was built mostly into a hillside with only a couple of ventilation pipes sticking out the top. This site was really just a couple rooms, not much was in here, with walls about a meter thick, or roughly 3 feet. So it's still fairly well secured, even as the years go by.
Okay.
So one purpose or a good usage of these abandoned structures is actually bats. So bats have been found to kind of shelter in a lot of these abandoned bunkers, and it makes sense. They really aren't that too different from a cave, you know? It's insulated. It's just concrete. A bat doesn't care as long as they can slip in and out. So during the 2010s, some of these structures were part of a winter survey to locate nesting sites for bats. And of course, as surveys went, they were popping into a bunch of these bunkers, checking in. But this one was different. Because they found ants. Lots of ants. Millions of ants. No bats.
Is there a correlation between the presence of all the ants and the lack of bats?
I don't think so. No. There's no correlation there. It was just odd because they just kept finding bats. Or not a ton. You know, every now and then you'll get a little bat. Maybe a roach fell in there. But millions of ants inside a mostly sealed underground nuclear bunker. You know, that's not something you see every day.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that you'd find roaches in there. A lot of these kind of abandoned areas have roaches.
I mean, everything's got a roach. And I'm sure it's like a stray, you know, he just kind of got lost, worked his way in there.
If you got teenagers who are just, you know, sitting in there up to no good, you're bound to have a roach or two.
They actually spread the roaches as they go. They hitch rides. They're backpacks. Maybe. It could happen.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Okay. So, like I said, lots of ants. This effort was led by Dr. Chekowski, who ventured down into the bunker to study the situation after he was informed of their existence. So this bunker was just a couple rooms, mostly empty, minus some rubble, dirt, and tons of ants. These were European wood ants, which is a larger species of ant that typically dwells in forests. In fact, one colony can span over several hectares. They can build really large ant mounds. Like, this is a very big species, very territorial as well.
So when you say a large ant, exactly how large are we talking? How long is the average individual?
Less than an inch, but as far as ants go, I mean, that's, I'd say it's comparable to a carpenter ant, eastern carpenter ant, if you're in the United States.
Okay.
Which, you know, that is a larger ant.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, those are larger ants.
It's nothing like, what was it? Yeah, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull ants. Weren't they like the size of your hand or something like that?
Maybe. I tried to forget a lot of that movie, if I'm going to be honest with
you. It's worth forgetting.
Yeah.
And I like the older ones where George Lucas, he didn't really care what he was putting in the pits with all the animals. He's like, all right, put it in there. We can get access to it. there's a scene in Temple of Doom where they're like surrounded by bugs and like they're all freaking out. But it's like stick insects and like leaf bugs and they don't hurt you. They're big.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. I feel like whenever they fell into a pit or of something or a cave or whatever, like, and they were trying to decide what would be in said cave, George Lucas just went up to a random producer and was like, you, what are you really scared of? And then the guy was like, snakes. And Lucas was like, all right, we're going to have snakes everywhere, guys. It's going to be great, you know? Or he's like, hey, you're really scared of those weird stick insects, right? And the guy's like, yeah. All right, we're going to have stick insects everywhere. Like that, I feel like that's just kind of how it worked for a while. And then in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, it was, what are you really afraid of? Well, I don't really like ants. And Lucas was just like, all right, now we're going to have ants everywhere.
With those movies, like, I think he had some in mind, like, all right, a lot of people are afraid of snakes. But he didn't think like, oh, let's get a snake that looks like a venomous snake or let's train a venomous snake. It's like, no, let's get every single snake and put it in this pit. You know, whatever we can get our hands on.
Sure.
It kind of reminds me of the movie Holes, if you're familiar with it, where they had these like made up venomous lizards and they just kind of painted bearded dragons.
Yeah. Yep. And didn't that, yeah. I just remember watching that movie in bits and pieces during various like assemblies at school or free periods, you know, it's like one of those movies that they would always play for some reason. I never understood why. So I didn't really remember it fully. I just kind of remember bits and pieces and not like the whole thing. Didn't Sigourney Weaver have like poisonous nails or something like that in that movie?
For the life of me, I don't remember. I remember the scene in the end where they're like covered in lizards. And it was like, those are bearded dragons. And a bit with onions. They ate onions at one point.
Oh, that's, I do remember something about onions. Yes.
That's all you're getting out of me.
Yeah, I don't remember anything else. Weird movie. Really weird movie.
Yeah. Anyways. But so, these are wood ants. These species need to have a lot of old growth forests around them because they rely largely on aphids as a food source. We've talked about this a little bit where ants will feed off of the sugary excrement of the aphids and in turn they will defend them from predators. So the aphids are almost like cattle for them.
Yeah, the lacewings that we've previously discussed know all about this.
Yeah, in this case, they do rely solely on them. In fact, their scientific name, which I don't remember offhand, but I believe is the ancient Greek word for cattle, their species name, which is because they're often found with aphids. That's like their main food source. So they tend to rely on aphids and thus trees by extension so much that sometimes they can't even establish on small islands, like islands that people could live on. If there's not enough forest for them, they can't establish there. One study found that they were living on a small island, less than 0.2 hectares in size, a really tiny island, and they were thriving solely off a single pine tree, which was the only pine tree on the island. And that was their food source. That was the only thing they had to work with.
Man, those ants must know all about the Christmas spirit. Just rely solely on one pine tree. You know, they try so hard to keep that pine tree alive.
It probably looks like the Charlie Brown pine tree. You know, it's on a tiny island. That thing is barely hanging in there, but they got to milk it for all it's worth.
Right, that or the first tree that the tree salesman shows the dad in the Christmas story where all the needles are falling off.
So it is a bit confusing on how these wood ants were surviving in an abandoned bunker. There are no aphids underground because there are no trees underground in a bunker in complete darkness. It became clear very quickly to the researchers that ants couldn't actually leave. So there were cracks to go in, but they were all in the middle of the ceiling, and the ants actually lacked the ability to climb on the ceiling. It was too slick for them. They could climb up the walls, but they couldn't climb on the ceiling. They couldn't get out.
So somebody just lubed the hell out of the ceiling?
Yeah, maybe. Don't know what they're doing in that bunker.
Or why the lube got on the ceiling. That sounds like a party right there.
So there were some alternate food sources in the bunker, a couple mites and spiders found inside, and bat guano could also serve as a food source. None of these were in a high enough quantities to support this many ants.
Okay.
And then they kind of put it all together. They found the ant corpses. They were estimated to be over 2 million based off a square meter analysis. Like, they literally had to take a little plot, count the ants on that, and use that to estimate how much was in the bunker, because there were that many.
That's how you know you have just way too many of something. It's when you have to just take a sample and extrapolate. That's the point where the researchers just go, man, we cannot get enough interns in here to count all these damn ants. We gotta just guess.
Yeah, just send them into the underground bunker in complete darkness, surrounded by ants. I'm sure the interns will love that. Even a square meter analysis, like, I would want to do that in there.
No, neither would I. But just imagine that job posting. Like, what the hell do you have to say to get somebody to take that position, you know?
Ant hole.
Do you enjoy dark enclosed spaces? Do you want all of the danger and fear and mental trauma of a coal miner with none of the monetary rewards? Well, have we got a job for you.
Now, I like to think they just say, the job posting just says, go in ant hole. Count. Very straight to the point.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just got to be blunt, I guess.
The researchers noted that all the ant corpses, again, there were many, showed signs of cannibalism, about 93% of all of them. Which what ants will do, they tend to do this when they raid rival colonies. So again, they are territorial, they'll fight each other. Sometimes if they have dead or dying counterparts and they are in desperate need of food, they will eat them as well. So it's not unheard of for these ants to do this. Most ants will as well. And another key component was the lack of any ant larva, pupa, or reproducing queens, because mind you, most worker ants are sterile. Only a select few are capable of reproducing. So it kind of makes you wonder, what's going on in here? What are all these ants doing in here? Where are they coming from?
Right.
And essentially, it's a death trap. The paper that described this ant colony did so with parentheses around it the entire time, because it's not self-sustaining. The actual colony was above ground. The ant mound at the top was actually so large it eventually spread and nearly engulfed one of the ventilation pipes. So ants had just been falling down into this dark pit for years. And like I said, the ceiling was too slick for them to walk on, so the ants just remained down there. And it's a pretty morbid situation. Again, worthy of a horror movie adaptation. And the strangest bit out of all of this is how the ants' behavior changed when they entered the pit. Because the strange thing is, it didn't change at all. So most animals of higher intelligence, like say a mammal, a bird, reptile, if you dropped a bunch of them in this bunker with no light or food, they're going to freak out. They're going to try to crawl out or cry for help, etc. If you put a bunch of chimpanzees in there, they're probably not going to have a good time.
Right.
The ants just kept functioning like usual.
What does like usual mean, though?
So a lot of these ants were either on their way out of the nest or on their way back to the nest. And when they're doing that, they're usually carrying something. So at the base of the ventilation pipe, where most of the worker ants fell in, many were actually carrying dirt that had been excavated to expand the colony. You know, they're digging down, making more tunnels. When they fell into this pit, they dropped the dirt in with them. And these ants actually reassembled the dirt into new ant mounds on the floor of the bunker. So the bunker is still, you know, it's 3 feet of cement. They're not digging through that. As each time an ant falls in with like a little bit of dirt, they just started reassembling a new colony down there for no real reason. To put this in a human perspective, imagine you're part of a cleanup crew for like a collapsed building, and you and all the volunteers were carrying off the rubble, and every now and then somebody slips into a giant pit. It's like instead of trying to get back out, you just use the rubble to build a new city down there.
So this pit basically turned these ant workers into Sisyphus, essentially.
Yeah.
Where they're just trying to do this mindless task over and over and over again with no point.
Well, I mean, they can actually achieve something. Like, they built a little city down there. Like, it's not just like a constant pushing a boulder up the hill. But again, it's kind of all in vain. It's like, you know, what for? I guess something for the next guy to enjoy when he falls down. Another thing the ants are known for is they typically store the dead or dying ants in large piles. They actually have like kind of like a graveyard for other ants. That's something they'll typically have. They did that here too. The ants would form large piles of their dead brethren, but also other insects that fell into the pit. So sometimes ants were coming back from like a little, I don't know, they caught a bug. It's going to be food, carrying it back to the nest. They fall in. Well, even with the dead bug, when they're done eating it, they still stored it away in these piles.
Interesting.
They didn't break down, they just kind of stayed there. And the ants weren't all turning on each other like Lord of the Flies, they were actually just eating the dead ants prior to them. So like I said, 90% of all the dead ants showed signs of cannibalism.
Right.
They weren't hunting each other, it was when one ant would pass, they would eat that ant, and then they would... when there's nothing left, they store it in the corner, in the graveyard.
So the ants never attacked each other?
No. No, they did not. They kept functioning like a colony, even though it was not self-sustaining at all. And essentially, it was a death trap.
I should note that this is officially beyond the point where I know where the story is going.
Yeah, yeah. Now that it's all genuine.
Right. We didn't get to this point in our previous recording. I'm genuinely amazed. That's insane.
So
they just kept working together as like one kind of impromptu colony?
Yeah. They carried out the task the best they could. Obviously, they couldn't leave the colony. They would still kind of walk around in long lines that really led to nowhere. There was one area where there was a door frame where it was easy for them to... they could actually crawl on the door frame on the bottom of it. They couldn't crawl on the ceiling. They would just kind of go up and down the door frame, almost like a highway that leads to nowhere. And throughout the day, they would kind of move up and down the walls. Really just doing nothing, just kind of waiting out till it's their time to go. Almost seems like they were robots in this sense, where they were just programmed to do something. And in a sense, they are. Ants are really interesting. If you ever had an ant farm as a kid, You know, you get this little box with sand in it and you throw a bunch of ants in there. The ants will dig out a little home in the sand pit, even though they're separated from their colony and their queen. You know, they can't keep going on. Like, the colony will die out with them. But they don't really care. They're just kind of following instinct. It's a really interesting kind of behavioral study on the ants.
And so, essentially, this just became like a giant ant farm in an old nuclear bunker?
I guess a giant ant farm, fueled by cannibalism, but respectful, tasteful cannibalism.
Yes, tasteful cannibalism.
They're not proud of it, but, you know, they do what they gotta do. And every time they fall in, they know that they'll be eaten too. Yeah, circle life.
Right, cannibalism, but without the murder, to be clear.
Yeah, without the murder.
We're cannibals, but we're not killers.
It's consensual.
Well, it's not consensual. It's hard to get consent from a corpse, but sure.
I'm sure they'd be okay with it. I mean, they did it too, so it's like...
The only way that could be consensual, Aaron, is if ants have wills, and I'm pretty sure that's not the case.
A couple interesting takeaways for this study. So, one, this was a great opportunity to really learn the limits an ant colony can tolerate. I mean, again, we saw how they survived on an island, you know, tiny island with a single pine tree, but this is a whole new level. There's been ants documented living inside electronics, cars, all sorts of man-made structures. You probably have had one in your house at one point or another. And I don't know if you remember freshman year of college, I stepped in a muddy puddle with my Converse sneakers, and I put them through the wash and I let them dry. I flipped them and put them on the air conditioner, and I let them stay there for a couple days, and I flipped them, and they were filled with ants. They were living in the air conditioner, and they crawled out and moved into my shoe.
No, I remember. I was there when you flipped them over. You were like, oh, I got to take the Converse off the air conditioner. And then you flipped them over, and you were like, ah!
Yeah,
and then you immediately you grabbed your shoes and ran into the bathroom, and we were like, what the hell is going on?
They started crawling on my arm. It caught me off guard. I started shaking them off into the sink because I didn't know what to do. I ended up putting them in the microwave for a couple minutes because I thought I just wanted to kill the ants. And they did survive that. Some of them did. So then I put them in a bag and I tossed them in the freezer.
I love how both of your solutions to this problem involved making the ants everyone else's problem, because not only have you brought the ants into the bathroom that everyone else uses, you have also brought the ants, wait for it, into the microwave where people cook food.
Well, in the end, I just threw out the shoes. I decided they were beyond saving. I had them for quite a few years. Their time was done. And I had crew practice the next day. I was on the rowing team, and it was late. And I didn't really want to go because, like, I was going to be getting 5 hours of sleep at that point. And one of my teammates just said, hey, just a heads up, if you call out and don't go to practice tomorrow, I'm telling the coach it's because you had to microwave your sneakers. So I just sucked it up and went to practice.
Yeah, you really... You probably didn't want to tell the coach why you had to microwave your sneakers, but if the coach ever listens to this podcast, they'll know now.
What else? This whole situation demonstrates some kind of interesting. Ants can be found all across the world. They adapt extremely well to many environments except like extreme cold or extreme heat. But even then, like, they have workarounds. And they live in tons of man-made structures. There's one environment they don't often appear in. It's actually a bit surprising, and those are caves. So it's not uncommon for an ant to wander into a cave, fall down a crack, but in most cave environments, there's just not enough resources to sustain a large ant colony, because ants form colonies. They can have a lot of ants in them. They need a lot of food. So most insects you find in caves, granted they're very adapted to cave life, but they probably have a very low metabolism. They're probably solitary, and they just don't eat much. They scavenge whatever they can get. And for a large ant colony, you just can't make that work. The only exception are very large caves, usually in tropical regions or coastal regions that might have a bunch of bats living in them year round, or yeah, some species of birds, because all that poop is enough to support a more dynamic ecosystem.
Right. I remember I've seen documentaries where whole colonies of insects and other invertebrates are sustained on little more than just the poop from bats or birds in those caves.
Yeah, so for most of these smaller caves, where granted bats can still appear, you really need a large amount to support an ant colony. You'll still have other bugs in there, but you won't have ants. Now, to wrap things up, there's only two papers published about this nuclear bunker cannibal ant colony. The first was this discovery, and the second was a closer look to confirm that the ants were in fact living off cannibalism. And the colony, in parentheses, no longer exists. So the researcher who wrote the first paper, Dr. Jakowski, got angry letters asking why he just left the poor ants down there in the bunker.
What?
People were writing in. They were upset about it. So in his second visit, he put 2 2x4s together, propped it up against a ventilation pipe, and the ants had a way to get out. And that was the end of it. By the next visit, they were all gone. They probably still fall down there, but at least now they have a ramp, albeit a bit of a long walk. They got a way out. But happy ending. They all moved back up to reunite with the colony, and the bunker was almost entirely empty by the next visit.
I mean, I guess that's good for the ants, but it sounds like it was really fascinating to study.
I mean, yeah, but I feel like they learned what they needed to. You know, the ants were cannibalizing.
Yes, but we already agreed that that was more ethical cannibalism, Aaron.
All right, it was more ethical. I don't think they liked it. You know, never seeing the sun for the rest of your life tends to put a damper on people's moods.
Sure, but that puts it. But you said the essential word there. It puts a damper on people's moods. People aren't used to living underground.
I don't know, the ants probably appreciate some vitamin D.
They might not. Who are you to interpret the psychology of an ant?
You know what? There's probably a study on that. I'm not even joking. Like,
there probably is. But
sunlight affecting ants' behavior?
Neither of us wrote it, so.
Anyways.
I feel like we're not qualified to comment.
Maybe next time. That is my piece on the cannibal nuclear bunker ants. It's a very clickbaity name.
Yeah, it's especially clickbaity if you put like a picture of some kind of mutant giant ant on the thumbnail.
Now, what I do is I make it like one of those Snapchat stories, like you won't believe what they found in abandoned bunker, and it'll be like a clip art of a guy screaming. Of those that bothered me the most was. It was like this guy woke up at 5 a.m. every day for 30 days. And it was like day one and he looks happy. And then it was like split down the middle and said day 30 and he kind of looks like a zombie. I'm like, how out of touch are you with the working class? Many people get up at 5 a.m. daily for work.
Yeah, my alarm goes off at 5:30, guys.
I get up at 5:30 every day. Like, are you kidding me? Get out of here.
I don't look like that. Stop it.
Like, just that one bothered me a lot. But that's Snapchat for you.
I look so good that I started a podcast.
Wow, I don't. That's why I do a podcast. You don't get to see me.
Right. That's why I was funny. All right. Anyway. So. Anyway, I think it's my turn now.
Yeah, what do you got for me? I have no idea what this will be.
He really doesn't. We didn't get this far. We promise. He has no idea what my topic is, for real. When people think about ants, they often consider them to be like the very pinnacle of teamwork. Like, think about the ants in your bunker. We're still like working together and building a colony in the darkness for no one and nothing in particular. Despite the fact that they were separated from their queen and all this other stuff, and they had no real reason to do so. And this is generally how people think of ant colonies, as very cooperative. you know, where ants are working tirelessly. They're lifting things that are many times heavier than themselves, you know, all for the greater good of the colony. And in a lot of cases, this rule does hold true, even as it turns out, in abandoned Soviet nuclear bunkers. But, however, we have a constant refrain on this show, which is that for every rule in biology, there is an exception.
Always. There's always going to be an oddball.
Yes. And as it turns out, some ants are not team players at all. Some, in fact, are useless, lazy freeloaders that mooch on the hard work of other ants without contributing in the slightest. And some go even further, where they take over those colonies and even steal the larvae of other colonies to rear as their own workers. These ants, as a group, are known as the social parasites. How familiar are you with these guys?
I think I've heard of them, but now I feel like we talked about them once or twice in college. But again, there's a lot of ants.
Yes. Yes, there are. There are actually hundreds of species of socially parasitic ants, and they have several different methods and morphs and come in different shapes and sizes. So in this piece, I'm going to be giving a general overview of the main types of ant parasites here. The first group are the freeloaders. This is the couch potato group. All they do is try to look or smell enough like a member of another ant colony to infiltrate it, and then live their lives by taking the food collected by the workers of that colony while providing no tangible benefit of their own. Eventually, these ants will leave their host colony and then use their sex pheromones to find another mate, and then the pregnant queens will either re-infiltrate the colony they just left or otherwise find another victim. And thus the cycle continues on and on and on. In other cases, the parasitic ants will actually make their own colonies within the colonies of the host. They are able to do this because they look and act enough like the hosts to hide their really mischievous nature. However, they don't produce workers, so they don't contribute anything to the actual colony that they're inhabiting. They just steal their food and take up space. That's it. That's why they're called parasites.
Yeah, social parasite is a good name for them.
Right, honestly.
We all had a housemate or two like that at some point.
Yep.
If you lived in a college dorm, you knew someone. Or you had a friend that roomed with someone like that.
The real fascinating bit here, really, are the methods of subterfuge used by these ants to penetrate these colonies. Because, as you might imagine, the host colonies don't like intruders, whether they're ants or other insects. In particular, they don't like freeloading ants that come in and steal their food. The ants will have a series of chemical and social cues which differentiate the colonial ants from the intruders. The key for the parasitic ants is to mimic these cues well enough to convince everyone that they're actually part of the colony. And as a result, many of these imitator ants are actually closely related to the species they parasitize. And the parasitic ants are highly specialized. They generally focus on one particular species or type of ant.
Brings a very interesting question about their evolution.
It does.
Yes. Does that come later?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. I'll wait. Yeah.
These ants are actually specialized to the point where they naturally produce the chemical markers of their hosts, or at least they produce a very convincing mimic of these chemicals. However, there are other ways of getting past these colonial defenses. Some ants in the genus Formicoxenus are known as shampoo ants because they will actually drag workers from a potential host colony away and then coat themselves with the colony scent. This then enables them to infiltrate the colony without anyone noticing because they are coated themselves with that.
What do they do to the workers?
Just let them go, really.
They don't say like, hey, I got mugged. I just got kidnapped, you know, like a couple minutes ago. That guy did it. He just shaved me. And
Aaron, if there's one thing that they should take away from your piece is that the worker ants are pretty much aren't deterred by anything, much less just having been randomly dragged away by another ant. Like, they'll fall into a pit and still try to get their job done. If they get randomly dragged off and have their bodies rubbed up against another ant, I think they're pretty much just going to shake that off and get back to work.
It's interesting in a human perspective, though. Like, I don't know. Imagine you're working at Costco and someone just drags you away, strips you down, takes your clothes off, and then walks into Costco and say like, oh yeah, I work here. And then the actual worker just walks in naked and everyone's fine with it.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, it's a Tuesday. What can I say, guys?
That's pretty much what's going on here. Yeah, exactly. But really, it's the analogy I came up with for this was, it's kind of like the ants are putting on one of those face masks from Mission Impossible. Or otherwise doing what the bug did in the first Men in Black movie. Literally stealing the skin of a human. I should also note that there's also a remarkable exception within the genus Formicoxinus itself. And that would be Formicoxinus nitigilis. This group goes in a completely different direction. Because rather than trying to blend in with the ant colony by mimicking their chemical profile, these guys actually produce a chemical deterrent. So the nitigilous ants stroll up to a host colony, smelling so repulsive that when a worker from the colony tries to pick them up and throw them out, the worker is overcome with the stench and just drops them.
That reminds me of It's Always Sunny, the reunion episode, when they're giving Charlie the wedgie, but his underwear is so gross that it just kind of crumbles apart. The guy doesn't want to touch him anymore.
Yes. Charlie Kelly is a Formicoxinus nitigilis. Completely. This is his spirit animal. Not a cat. It's this ant. This strategy, though, is incredibly effective. So effective, in fact, that instead of only parasitizing one colony, Nitigilus is able to invade the colonies of as many as 11 different ant species. And just sit there and steal their food, and no one gets rid of them because they're so, so stinky. What's more, the chemicals that are produced by the Nitigilus are so repulsive that when researchers coated otherwise desirable food items with the Nitigilus juice, the worker ants wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. Which, really, as far as the study is concerned, seems like a really cruel trick because they're just covering something delicious with a foul smell. So it's kind of like taking a slice of pizza and coating it with, I don't know, sewage or bleach or pineapple.
I would not want to eat that pizza. You're saying it like putting sewage on the pizza just makes it smell bad. No, I'm still eating that.
You would eat sewage covered pizza?
No, I'm saying you're making it sound like just putting the scent on it and like the sewage itself is not getting in the pizza.
You wouldn't have questions if you opened a pizza box and it smelled like poop?
No, but the way you were wording it was like just the smell got stuck to it. But then you say putting sewage on a pizza. I'm like, well, it's all over the food now.
Right. Right. But that analogy still holds true because the juices of the Nitigilus were covered the food in this study in the same way that the sewage would cover the pizza.
But the food is still good for the ants.
Sure.
That's the difference. That's the difference there. The ants, someone is still eating that food at the end of the day. You put sewage on a slice of pizza, that's a lose-lose. None of us are happy with it. No one's eating that pizza.
All right, fair enough.
If you could, like, put fake mold on it, you know, that's, like, the next best thing I could think of.
I guess. But...
like, if I have a pizza and a coworker comes over and he pours sewage on it and he says, well, now you're not going to want to eat it, so I'm going to. I'm going to look at him like, you want to eat that? It's on the pizza. It doesn't just stink. That's not good for you.
Well, to be clear, this is how we got the Ninja Turtles. So, like, they just ate pizza in the sewers all the time. You can't tell me that they didn't eat sewage-covered pizza.
Yeah, but that's a whole other topic. The cleanliness of the Ninja Turtles. You know, that's probably strategy. The Shredder doesn't even want to touch them. Yeah, they're coming up covered in poo. That's how they're so successful.
Yes. Michelangelo read this study about the former Coxinus Nitigulus and said, hey, guys, this is finally how we can beat that Shredder guy. We'll just be as repulsive as possible.
I mean, if I'm robbing a bank and a, you know, 6 foot tall, turd covered turtle comes running in yelling cowabunga, I don't want to be anywhere near the guy. I don't even want to fight him. Even if I could fight him, who wants to touch him? It's the fecal shields all over again.
Maybe, maybe not. It depends on how badly I want the money. If I'm desperate enough to rob a bank, I very well could be desperate enough to fight a poop-covered turtle.
These are the questions we should be asking.
These are the scientific studies that we need to be funding.
Oh, man, we've gone off tangent a lot in this one.
We really have, yeah. Anyway, getting back to business. But that's the former Coxinus Nitigulus. Now, they've also found kind of hybrid ant colonies where some individuals are just producing a lot of queens instead of workers. And so they're kind of taking advantage of the system and producing their own offspring and really just acting as kind of pseudo social parasites. So the idea here is that these kind of freeloading queens eventually evolved into true parasites of a completely separate species. And so over time, you evolve this highly specialized parasitic ant, which is why then, like I was discussing earlier, a lot of these ants are related to the species they parasitize. To answer your earlier question.
Yeah, I was thinking like if it just evolved like where there's a split, I guess, in a specific ant colony. You know, where some just stopped working.
Yes, yes, precisely. Precisely. All of this leads me to the second group, which are the invaders, not the freeloaders. So, some of these parasitic ants are a bit more ambitious than just their freeloading relatives. They still want to cheat the system, but they want to gain power. They want control. So instead of just blending in and living their lives like masquerading as other ants, they take over and they invade the colony. These species are mostly like non-parasitic ants, but they have one major exception, one major difference, that is. They cannot establish their own colonies. So fledgling queens, instead of going off and trying to find their own refuge and develop their colony from there, they will go and infiltrate the colonies of other ants, not unlike the freeloaders in some cases, where they use the same kind of chemical markers and make their way through the colony. But once inside, they execute a coup because they'll kill the colony's original queen and take her place. The colony's workers, with no other queen to serve, help this usurper queen raise her workers and her offspring. Eventually, the workers from the invading queen grow numerous enough to supplant the original workers, at which point the colony has basically been taken over by this, you know, usurper queen. And from this point on, the invading queen produces new queens to go take over other colonies, and this process continues over and over and over again. Because they only infest a host colony for a bit before eventually supplanting it, these ants are known as the temporary social parasites, because eventually they'll just completely take over. And once they've fully taken over, they're no longer parasites. There's nothing left to parasitize.
Yeah, fair enough.
So that's why they're temporary. There is another offshoot of the invader group that is often considered a separate parasitic class unto itself. However, they start off by invading a nest, so I kind of lumped them in with the invaders. And this group is the slavers. So, once an invading queen has completed her coup, sometimes she needs to supplant her workforce and can't produce enough workers to grow the colony the way she wants. The solution in this situation is the same one used by the cities of Astapor, Yunkai, and Meereen in Game of Thrones. If you had seen Game of Thrones, you'd know where I was going with this. Basically, they conduct raids on neighboring colonies and steal their workforce. Specifically, the victimized colony will be robbed of their larvae, some of whom are eaten, but most of whom are brought back to the invaders' colony and raised as worker ants for those slavers. The kidnapped workers basically think that they belong to the colony of their kidnappers, not unlike birds that imprint upon humans as chicks and then go through life thinking they're people. These larvae basically imprint upon the workers of their, you know, raiding colony and think they are the same species as the raider ants. And this can sometimes explain why you crack open an ant mound and find different color ants running around, because some of those ants were stolen from another colony. And they've wound up working for their, you know, kidnappers, basically. In some cases, these raids are so damaging to the victim colony that many ant colonies will actually tolerate freeloading ants living in their colonies if the freeloading ants have chemical defenses, which can help ward off the raiders. So, sometimes the freeloaders can act as mercenaries who protect the host colony in the event of an attack.
Now that's just a whole other layer right there. That I didn't know. That's really cool.
It really is, isn't it?
So, it pays off to tolerate, to an extent, some of these social parasites.
Yeah. But you gotta know which ones are the good ones to keep around, right?
Or at the very least, you keep them around and hope when you do get raided that those are the ones that get taken away.
Right, exactly. So sometimes the freeloaders are the first ones to get taken away. Other times, the host colony just doesn't even know about the freeloaders because they blend in so well. And other times, the freeloaders are actually helpful because they help ward off the slavers. So there are all kinds of layers to this, and it takes so many different forms in different areas because ants are so diverse. But and this is just a general categorization here. There are some ant species that fall into different aspects of this and kind of really blur the lines between these groups that I've set forth, which are generally the groups that most scientists use. But like we say, for every rule, there's an exception. And these rules that I've set forth here have lots of them, just because ants are so diverse. The raids that these ant colonies conduct can take a variety of forms and are really, really fascinating. Some slaver ants rely more heavily on the practice than others because being better at raiding other colonies also makes the raiders poorly equipped to take care of their own colony. So if you're a colony or a species that is really good at raiding other colonies, you tend to have, you know, really huge jaws and mandibles that are inconvenient for doing work in your own colony. So you have to do a lot of raiding to actually have ants that will help, you know, move rocks and collect food and do things like that. If you rely less on raiding, you might have smaller mandibles because you actually want to help build your own colony. So there are really a lot of degrees to this as well. I could just spend a whole nother podcast talking about it because there's so many different forms and they're so cool in a lot of ways. Anyway, at least for a brief overview, I felt that they were at least worth mentioning in this piece because a lot of them are technically social parasites and do invade other colonies before going out and then finding and then supplanting their workforce. So if there's enough interest, maybe we come back to it one day. But
yeah, I could always do an ant follow-up. That was really cool with the keeping social parasites around to, you know, aid in slaver ants, whether they act as kind of like fodder or even as a defense system.
Some of them really, you know, they pay their rent, so to speak. They're worth keeping around.
It's really interesting. It's like, it's like having an antique shop that gets robbed all the time. So you put all the really crappy stuff in the front. So when it gets stolen, you don't either A, you don't care, it's gone, it's worth next to nothing. Or you get like, I don't know, like stuff that really stinks, like so bad or like it's fallen apart or just gross. And you put that in the front of the store and people come in, they just don't even want to bother stealing. It's that repulsive.
Yeah. Yeah. The way I think about this from a human perspective, it's kind of like having those house centipedes in your basement. Like, the house centipedes themselves look really creepy and are, you know, kind of scary to some people. And people don't really like having them around, per se. But if you can tolerate them, they help keep away a lot of other really harmful pests in control.
That's true.
They're useful to have around.
If you're going to have some insect living in your basement, that's probably the best one to have.
Sure, sure. I mean, personally, I'm a little creeped out by them because they kind of sneak up on you. You turn on a light and they're just there. They're sitting on your wall.
One day at work, I was walking through like a kind of a lobby and one was running through. Just me and two other coworkers. We were all doing our own thing. We just stopped and watched across the room.
Yeah.
He just kind of, you know, it's there. What are we going to do about it?
Right, right. Yeah. That's kind of the way I think about some of the freeloader ants, you know? Of course, there are other freeloader ants that are completely useless. So, like I said, you got to, the trick for the host colonies is telling the difference.
You got to get feel for them. Read the resumes.
Yes, yes, exactly. So, that's pretty much my piece, though.
Yeah, well, really cool. I really like the end bit.
Good, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Also, the evolution aspect of how they are closely related to the species that they parasitize. That is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like having a bunch of freeloading cousins.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways. Or I was thinking, like, you have a bunch of lazy coworkers, and they kind of just start up a shell company in your office.
Yeah. That's another really good analogy, yeah. Yeah. We've talked before this, and you're thinking about doing a lakes episode next time, yep. Yeah?
I got a pretty good topic in mind.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a couple ideas for this one, and I thought it would be a good episode to do because, you know, summer's coming around, people will go on vacations to lakes, so... You know, it's a good theme.
Yeah.
Makes sense for this time of year. But with that decided, you want to take us out?
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can find us at Soup Pot Podcast on Twitter or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
All right. Sounds good. And until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.